So the reason I'm standing here to give this talk is because I loved a man and he died. And I know that that is no way a unique experience. It's a universal one, and many of you have had similar experiences to mine and could be standing here talking about them. So, you know, I know that what I'm going to say may remind you of things, but it's not new, it's not unique, it's just a very ordinary experience, really, death and dying. And only yesterday, as I was going back to my room to kind of polish this talk a bit, I turned on my phone and there was this text from Karen Amaya to say that her mother had died just an hour before. And so I couldn't go to my talk really, I had to just communicate that to as many people as I could find that knew her. Phyllis just died yesterday. I guess a lot of other people died yesterday too, that we don't know. So death is just a very commonplace occurrence, and yet we find it so unfathomable. It's just so mysterious. And I've been asked to talk about the insights I've gained from the experience of being alongside a loved one who died. And what I've gained from that experience. And, well, insight. The word insight, when I saw it in Parami's email, kind of made me shake a bit. Even with a small I, it seems like a grand word for what has come into my mind in preparing this talk. I mean, it may be a bit more like seeing things a little bit more clearly. So I'm just going to give you a little brief history for those that don't know. In 2002, in May, my dad died after a long, drawn-out process of illness, and my mum had been kind of wearing herself to a frazzle, really, in looking after him. So I was kind of interested in this death that was coming, kind of almost looking forward to it in a funny sort of way, because I hadn't experienced a death before. And so I was kind of said, come on, death, come to me and see what I get from it. So he died mid-May in that year. And by the end of June, my partner, Asanga Sheila, told me that he'd found a lump in his neck. And my heart sank because I just felt that I knew that it would be cancer. And I was just expecting that we'd go through a trying period of treatment, and he'd come through it. However, things progressed to the point where we, very shortly afterwards, got a diagnosis that was terminal, that he had lung cancer with secondaries in his lymph glands and in his liver. So he had a very short period of time. And he chose not to have chemotherapy because that kind of kept him well in a funny sort of way. So he died on the 7th of December. So we had about 4 months. And I was thinking about it, there were insights that I gained during the time of those 4 months, you know, that while he was ill and facing his death. And then some other things arose after he died. There was lots of fear and anxiety during that time. And reading my journal, there was often a desire, when I was reading it recently, to put my suffering in a bigger context. You know, that's what I was writing at the time, that I was trying so hard to see through death. I was craving. I read this thing that was saying, if only I could have insight. I was craving for insight in order to escape the suffering. And, you know, that's completely upside down thinking, isn't it? You know, craving for insight and then I won't suffer. You know, it just doesn't work like that. And I was also trying to see the connection between suffering and faith. And that is often, for me, quite a big gap, actually. You know, we say, suffering leads to faith and faith leads to joy or something else, I can't remember now, my spiral path, but that bit between suffering and faith, oh, how the suffering, when you're in the midst of suffering, how does it lead to faith? It's a very, very hard question. And I was thinking, does big suffering lead to big faith? No, it doesn't. It doesn't. And yeah, I can't quite remember. I think it's got something to do with awareness, hasn't it? You bring awareness to your suffering, yeah, and that leads to faith somehow. But there was also joy in the moment, because actually, Asanga Sheila didn't live with me. He lived in a men's community and I lived in a small women's community. But during the last part of those four, for about the last 2 months, he came to live with me and I looked after him, because there was space in our community. And there was a lot of joy in some of those moments, you know. There wasn't a future. We didn't have a future. So I had to just focus on what was going on in this moment. And there was a lot of joy and fun in moments of just silly things, like he couldn't get a bath by himself because his legs were a bit wobbly. And so I helped him to have a bath. And I was sitting on the floor in the bathroom cutting his toenails. And it was such a happy moment, you know. And he looked down at me and he was saying, "You're my hero. Look at you cutting my toenails. You're my hero." You know, and it's just simple pleasure, really, that you can have if you're in the moment and not going, "Oh my God," you know. So I did all that I could to make him comfortable. I was working like crazy, actually, because I was giving him lots of fresh food. I was juicing, chopping up beetroots and making juice and stuff. And I actually got tennis elbow from cutting up vegetables. I did. And he was sitting in the room, in his room, reflecting on the Heart Sutra. And he was reflecting on emptiness. And I was doing all I could to keep the form going. And that really struck me. There's a bit out of my journal that I wrote. It's about 10 days before he died. And it's interesting doing this talk because you know when he died. I've told you. But I had no idea when it was going to be. You know somebody's going to die, but somehow I kept thinking, I wonder if he'll see the leaves come back in the springtime, you know? I wrote on the 28th of November, "I'm not really prepared for his death, not really. But I look at him. He looks ill. His body has lost much muscle tone, but his hands are warm and strong. How do you get past loving the form, rupa, body? When it's gone, maybe. That's when I have to. I can't do it now." So he died on the 7th of December, and it did seem sudden. He got suddenly worse, and he went into the hospice, St. Christopher's Hospice, that day. And he sent us away. There was me, Vandana Jyoti, Mokshika, and Jayaka, all with him that day. And once he'd settled into the room, he just sent us all away. And I went away thinking, does he want to just get on with dying, you know, by himself? And I didn't really trust my instincts. I just went anyway. And he died that night on his own. And I think he just couldn't be doing with us. He just had to look the other way and go for it, you know, just go for death. And he did give a lot. A lot of people said to me afterwards that they gained a lot of courage in dying because of the way he died. And one of those people was Mahananda, who died just a wee while ago. I don't suppose he got quite... I don't know if he had time to know he was dying, because it was very, very sudden. So I was listening to Subhuti's talk that he gave in India after Sudarshan and Bodhisaki died. And he's good, isn't he, Subhuti? He said, "Death comes and sweeps it all away." And I just really felt that expression. Death comes and sweeps it all, you know, like someone just crashing everything to the floor. And that's just what it does. And it hurts so much. And I thought I'd go mad, actually, at times. I thought the pain was so much bigger than me. And I was so scared of it as well. It just used to sweep over me. You know, overwhelming. And I couldn't bear it, and I had to bear it. There was no escaping bearing it. What else could I do? Subhuti also said, death asks us the biggest questions, like what am I doing with my life? And Mudita Sri's kind of talked a bit about that. Subhuti was talking about Maitri and Karuna and Pranya. And I thought, well, I practice kindness and compassion, looking after a Sanghashila. Where's the Pranya? Couldn't quite see it. Not at that time, anyway. And I still continued my sort of search for wisdom, you know, to try and put a bigger space around this terrible suffering I was feeling. I used to reflect on the Kisagotami story. I think I was just so hard on myself in a way. I was kind of hammering myself on the head with wise things, you know, trying to get the wisdom in. Please! But actually, you just have to go through it. You know, the pain is just has to be born, I guess, and something comes in time. And one of the things I thought after I died actually was I'll never need to be anxious again because the worst thing has happened. And here am I standing in front of you with a completely dry mouth, wondering what the time is. Oh my God, I've only got a minute and. So I wanted to talk about attachment, which is one of the things, because I'm a greed type. I go towards people. I'm an attaching type. So that's what I do, and I can't help it. But I know it causes suffering. I really do know it causes suffering. And I was saying to Shubhmai in my room the other night, I was saying to her, I think I feel like telling people, split up from your relationships. Do it now, because it'll be easier, you know? Don't wait until one of you dies, because it's terribly painful. And so I did. I had this idea. I think I spoke to Maitreyi. As soon as we got the diagnosis, I said to her, gosh, this means I could be an Anagarika, maybe. And it had been something that I'd wished I could be, but had a lover, and I wasn't going to give him up. So he gave me the opportunity. Bless him. To move away from that attachment to a lover, to a specific person, and be on the path of aloneness, standing alone. You know, I can't say I've got very far on it. I've got three lovely grandchildren who I'm absolutely besotted by, so you know they force attachment on me. I can't do anything about that really, but I see it as suffering as well, you know. I do. Now I can't see my notes, whatever I was going to say. I think the last thing I wanted to say is something about just being a bit more familiar with death and dying, being a bit more comfortable around people who are experiencing bereavement. I sort of can stand alongside somebody. I don't need to understand, or I can just be there somehow. I do bereavement counselling work now, and I just have a confidence, I think. I just feel confident about it, about being alongside people who are bereaved, that I can just be there. You know, that's all really that you need to do. But just be there and let them be what they want to be in their bereavement, and not kind of try and fix them. You know, So And I think I've learned also to be a bit more gentle with myself, trying not to hammer myself on the head with wisdom, that it sort of probably seeps in somewhere, you know, underneath. Yeah, so I'm going to finish there, because my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you.